Tonight on Arena, Minions, The Rise of Gru, Nitram, and Irish-made documentary Castro Spies are the movie up for review, and a new four-part documentary on the Rolling Stones. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Minions, The Making of a Mass Murderer, an Irish-made and an Irish-made documentary about Cuban spies. Those are the three films that we'll be speaking about this evening. And welcome to Thursday night's Arena. Such is the potential commercial power of Minions, The Rise of Gru that other films seem to loathe. They seem loath to take it on in this first box office weekend of July 2022. Major release, it's the only one really of note this week. The Little Yellow Guys are back, of course, as is Steve Carell in this 1970s set origin story. Perhaps we do or don't need. At quite the other edge of the emotional spectrum in every conceivable sense is Nitram, the harrowing true story of the life of the notorious Australian mass murderer Martin Bryant, who took inspiration from the horrors of Dunblane in his 1996 attack on the Tasmanian town of Port Arthur. And in the Irish documentary Castro's Spies, we get the story of five men who were jailed for espionage on behalf of Cuba, and they were jailed in the United States. Joining me in studio now is Ruth Barton, and down the line is Paul Whittington. Let's start with the release of the week, I think it's safe to say, in the case of Minions, The Rise of Gru. Paul, I hear you are often referred to as being a Minions whisperer. Why do the Minions vex film critics so much?
Well, I think, you know, from a certain point of view, they could be considered irritating. They speak kind of Esperanto gibberish and with a kind of helium overtones. And they buzz about, and that they're slapstick creations. The interesting thing is, the first time I saw the first one, Despicable Me, was before I had a child, and I thought, ho-hum. And the second time I saw it was with a child, and I thought, now I see. Because these minions speak to children, they really do, and as I'm sure you know, and they are childlike. They're a kind of antidote to the main character Gru, who's a kind of frustrated Bond villain who's capable of actual nastiness. So I can see the appeal, and certainly the some of these films have been not bad.
All right, have been not bad. Well, thank you for that fulsome praise of the Minions series, Paul. I suppose, Ruth, it is this idea. Steve Carell is front and centre really here as the Gru character. How important is he and what he does for this particular franchise?
Well, are you asking me plot wise? Because I just can't answer that question. But no, I mean, he's you know, it starts obviously with Despicable Me. And the funny thing, I mean, if there's anything funny about this film, is that he's now a child because it's an origin story, but he looks the same. I mean, he's exactly the same. He's kind of like a Dracula figure, I guess, modelled on Dracula. So I mean, I don't even know how important he is to this film, because this is really the Minion story. And so it's almost like he's the reason for it. Mm. But then just as they swamp him, I mean, there's a sequence where he's going to be interviewed to join the bad guys who are the Vicious Six, right? And he's at this stage, he's 11 and three quarters, as he tells us, the child. So he has to get an early night before his interview, and he gets into bed on his own. And the next thing is the minions all crowd in on top of them. They're doing that kind of cutesy babble. And at that moment, he's overwhelmed by them, and the film is overwhelmed by them. And what he does next is kind of irrelevant, because the whole energy is following the minions
themselves and their particular babble. Right, let's have a listen to a clip to see if that will elucidate things any further. Steve Carell's Gru is tied up at this point to the hands of a clock. The clock looks very much like Big Ben, you'd have to say, and he's being snarled at by an angry multicoloured dragon. We think this is Taraji P. Henson playing this particular character. And then the dragon turns to the minions and turns them into cute, fluffy animals. Did you follow all of that? Pierre Coffin voices the minions here.
You stole from us, and now you're gonna pay! Enjoy being torn apart!
Hey, Glutamagoo Carminibus! Go!
Why don't we make this a fair fight?
Oh, you thought I was serious.
Run!
All right. Yeah, I'm not sure how much
wise it is.
But Pierre Coffin, as I said to you during that particular piece, he voices all of the minions. He has different laughs for every single one of them.
Yeah, and apparently you can distinguish between them. Like, apparently if you're a fan, you actually know which one is which. To me, I mean,
I think you can.
Thank you, Paul, because I couldn't. I mean, some of them have one eye and some of them have two.
Go ahead, Paul.
They have different characters, Ruth. There's one called Kevin, or Kevin, as they call him, and Bob. And if you watch the series closely, as I have been required to do, he does manage to create characters for them, but not here. This is the second prequel, and the first prequel was okay. It was kind of funny. It was set in the 60s London, but this is just a bit of greed, I think, because that made a billion. All the other three Despicable Me films have made a billion. I just think this feels like it's been, it feels like it's been cut quite a bit, and supporting characters are weak. So yeah,
they're just looking for their next billion, I suppose.
But they'll get it.
Yeah, but Ruth, all of these big franchises, has there been any academic study on the minions and what they might or might not portray in terms of film?
In terms of post-capitalist society
and that's
our, our neoliberal culture and the loss of individualism, and I don't know, because I haven't been to that conference and I'm not going. But I'm sure there is an earnest PhD student sitting as we speak, losing sleep over exactly these questions. But it's not me and it's none of my students. I mean, I think that...
And we should...
Yeah, go on, Paul.
We should remember as well that Gru has a strong psychological backstory, in the sense that his mother, played by Julie Andrews, was indifferent to him, so that he has a constant need for notice. That's my excuse, anyway.
Yeah, so you're putting together a PhD proposal as we speak, it sounds like, Paul.
You're on, Paul.
I could write it.
Talk to you later.
I could write it, yeah.
Is there enough fun? Look, it's fun. Obviously, it's for children, and adults going might get with their children, might get the odd joke along the way and be happy with that. It does it work at that level, Ruth?
Yeah, I mean, all it is really it's an extended chase movie, because it starts with a very minimal backstory, and then the chase starts, because they have to get the guy who stole the stone, who the minions steal, and then they get the wrong stone, they sort of, et cetera. And they just, it's one long chase. And, you know, if that's all you want, it's fine. If you think that maybe your children could be elevated a bit by their entertainment, then you're in the wrong cinema. And I mean, if you're the adult going with it, I'm just saying, I came out, I felt I'd been assaulted by a troop of minions. I felt exhausted, just the constant babble. And I mean, there's kind of a fun soundtrack, but, interspersed with the rest of it.
And you're not suggesting we could take our children out afterwards and discuss post-capitalism with them, no?
Well, I mean, they may speak in a language that you don't understand when doing so.
Paul, have been to it as a film critic, obviously, to see to see the screening. Now, will you go back with a different hat on with your child, or how will that work?
I will. I'll go back with my party hat on and a balloon animal. And I think that Ruth is right. I have always been partial to their kind of Latinate stylings and their slapsticks, if I haven't minded, but in small doses. And there's kind of too much of them in this. And they didn't really pay attention to the era that they were setting it in. Like, there's a Tupperware joke involving his mother, Tupperware party, which is entirely thrown away. And it just feels like it's been written by a large number of people and rewritten by a large number of people. So it just doesn't, it's not quite funny enough. Yeah. And there actually isn't enough of Steve Carell, whose voiceovers I love in these films.
Well, most Tupperware is thrown away. But in terms of Jaws, Ruth, I think there's a wonderful scene where they're going to see Jaws.
They go to the cinema and they drop a stink bomb in the cinema to clear the audience out. And then they troop in and they watch Jaws and you hear them, squeaking commentaries. And then, and then they go into the cinema auditorium and they start playing with all the toys, and they take over the grabber, that the hand that goes in and picks out all the toys, and they take over the grabber and they sit in the grabber and they root amongst the toys. And by that stage I felt I was in the grabber, being rooted and chucked around the place. But it was, It's witty to an extent. It has, you know, lots of pop cultural references. The Tupperware parties, the soundtrack. You know, there's lots of blink and you'll miss it references going on, which I guess are for the adults.
Yeah.
The kids don't get it. But
Stars, Ruth.
It wasn't my idea of fun. Yeah, I really had to say, because I'm scared the minions will come and get me if I don't give it five, but I think it probably sort of 2.5 to 3.
2.5 to 3. You're hedging your bets there. Paul?
Yeah, 2.5 for me, I think it's about right. Not a classic of the genre.
Unless you go with your kid, in which case it's 5 stars.
Indeed.
All right, yeah, okay. Indeed. I think we're pretty clear on where both of you are on that one. Let's move on then to Nitram. And this is an entirely different proposal. Australian filmmaker Justin Kurzel, known for his challenging work, not least of which was 2011's true crime drama Snowtown, his visceral and at times horrifying adaptation of Macbeth, starring Michael Fassbender and Marion Cotillard from 2015. And of course, most recently, the true history of the Kelly Gang, a fictionalised telling of the life of the outlaw Ned Kelly. Australia's criminals clearly continue to fascinate the director, this time Martin Bryant, who murdered 35 people, wounded 23 others in a mass shooting in Port Arthur in Tasmania in 1996. The film stars Caleb Landry-Jones in a role that won him the Best Actor Award at Cannes last year, and he's joined on screen by Aussie acting royalty Judy Davis and Anthony LaPaglia as his parents. Ruth, the title here, Nitram, is Martin backwards, and there are everybody has gone to great pains here not to say Martin Bryant's name, but they are telling his story. Who was he, or who is he?
Well, who is he? This is a true story, as you say. In 1996, he murdered 35 people. He wounded a further 23 others in Tasmania, and it was a massive shock to Australian society, because this was something that appeared to only happen in America. He's Nitram because the filmmakers have reversed his name. So if it's Martin spelled backwards, and it plays into this idea that if you actually name the perpetrator of an atrocity, then you give them the fuel of publicity that they so seek. And so, but of course, ironically, here we are talking about him, and
yeah,
we're saying
we're
Martin
talking,
Bryant.
Course, yeah.
And I mean, I have to say that one of the first things I did out of, you know, just sort of, I don't know, kind of almost kind of nasty curiosity was I went back and I looked up. So where is he now? Well, he's still in prison. And he's, you know, serving 35 concurrent life sentences. He's never going to be in anything other than prison. But also, you know, what's quite uncanny almost is if you look at those photographs of him when he committed this atrocity, is how like him they've made the actor Caleb Landry-Jones look. It's uncanny, the likeness.
But Paul, what we get here is we don't get into some awful representation of the murders themselves. We're dealing with his development in fact, we first see him as a child in a hospital because he has burnt himself playing with firecrackers, and he's quite content that he will continue to do so. Then we come up to date kind of, I suppose, a couple of years before the atrocity, maybe closer to it than that. And we see clearly a young man who is in deep, deep trouble.
Yeah, absolutely. And the interesting thing, the film that this could most obviously be compared with is Lynn Ramsey's We Need to Talk About Kevin. But that goes back and forward through time, from the aftermath of an American school shooting to her remembering the childhood of this, you know, apparent monster she's created. This is really about how... Nitram, as he's called, which is a pejorative nickname from when he was growing up, by the way, is how he became so isolated, so divorced from any kind of reality or humanity. And it's very hard to watch, but it's really powerful. He's obviously very good. He got the Best Actor Award at Cannes last year, but Anthony LaPaglia and Judy Davis are outstanding as his parents. And you can see they're just exhausted. He has some kind of personality disorder, probably. His IQ is low, and he was not educatable. And he's just on the outside of everything. And he has this anger, which is terrifying. The parents live in permanent dread of it.
Yeah.
And you can see that they actually just do not know what to do. They're just living day to day.
Yeah, let's listen to a clip quite early on in the film here between Bryant, played by Caleb Landry-Jones, as we said, or Nitram, played by Caleb Landry-Jones. His father, played by Anthony LaPaglia, they're in a car, and he has just the Nitram character has just been giving firecrackers or fireworks to young guys outside a secondary school.
What with you? What is wrong with you?
What's wrong with him? He hates me.
He doesn't hate you.
Hey!
He just cannot have his students playing with fireworks at lunchtime. Stop it!
Well, told me to do something.
Yes, not this. Just...
Did you tell her?
No, of course not.
Did you tell her?
I'd be in trouble if I told her that I gave him back to you.
Who are my friends, though?
I know. I know that you're friends.
Who are my friends?
I know that you're friends.
They like
but
me.
You have to promise me. I can't keep my eye on you all the time. Okay? I'll tell you what. We'll go for a nice drive. All right? That's what we need to do. We need to go for a nice quiet drive.
Scene there from Nitram with the father character played by Anthony LaPaglia and the Nitram character played by Caleb Landry-Jones. And Ruth, I was saying to you before we came to air about this, I mean, Caleb Landry-Jones is such a fine actor.
Oh, he's stunning.
And he's taking a very difficult character here. How much does he make us and leave us sympathising with this particular character?
I think you'd have to be fairly disturbed to sympathise with him, you know, even throughout the thing. Even if, like, I mean, if you didn't know the story behind this, there's something really, really creepy about him. And there's the film is really cleverly shot. It's shot in all these kind of grey, browny, washed out colours. But it's the way that they position him. There are sequences in the home where his mother, I mean, she's absolutely fantastic.
Judy Davis.
She's sitting down and he kind of looms up behind her and you just feel his threat and they don't have to say anything. And even you get it in that exchange where they leave pauses between the sentences and he just looms up behind her and you think, I feel so threatened because you feel quite enclosed in that house as well. It's a kind of miserable house. And the whole time, because he's very blanked out, his face is very blanked out, you don't know what he's thinking, if he's thinking anything. You don't know what to expect. And then you get these sudden outbursts of anger and you don't know when they're going to happen because there's also he can be quite sweet in a certain way too, so you never know how he's going to respond.
Yeah, so it's
to
that volatility that's difficult to deal with. The director here, Kurzel, made a feature film that looks at Australia's most shocking crimes, a thing called Snowtown, Paul, that does that as well. But it's a real fine line here, isn't it? How does Kurzel, first of all, what's the style of filmmaking? Ruth has described it a little bit there for us, and what's his background?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, you mentioned Justin Kurzel has done things like Macbeth, which I really, really liked, and Assassin's Creed, which we need not mention here because it wasn't very good. But in a funny way, there's a sort of lyrical approach to the direction here, which as though it's a different kind of film and it plays against what's happening. And I think that's very clever because it allows you to feel the parents' desperation and it allows you on a human level to sympathize with somebody who has become so isolated and who has been allowed to become so isolated. And one might ask, you know, in retrospect, why was somebody like Martin Bryant allowed to live outside an institution when it was with the warning signs were there? But parents always hope and you can see them doing it. Mm. And as Ruth mentioned, Judy Davis is outstanding. There's one scene in which she sits and she's talking to Essie Davis's character, Helen, the older woman who's taken up with him, and she's saying, she tells her the story about his childhood, which just tells you what might be missing. And it's absolutely chilling and enthralling as a scene.
Yeah, he meets up with this older woman. He goes out to mow lawns in the neighbourhood and he meets up with this older woman who's not that, well, she's close enough to the age of his parents. There's a big age difference between him and her.
She's the kind of classic mad cat woman, except it's dogs, who lives on her own and again, kind of like maybe Miss Havisham sort of character. And so she lives in this creepy old house with this mass of dogs. And she takes him in and she strikes up a relationship with him. And again, I mean, this is something that his mother she wants to know, are you his mother? Are you his lover? Because she sits down with him in the cafe and she kind of looks blank. She doesn't say.
Let's have a listen to that clip, actually, which is between the Essie Davis playing the character of Helen and the mother played by Judy Davis. And they're meeting for the first time and it's Nitram's birthday is the day that they're meeting. And this is the conversation between the mother and the partner.
What exactly is going on here? Sorry, I don't know what you mean. He mows your lawn, you buy him a car. He mows it again, he moves in with you. What's next, marriage?
He needed a car.
He doesn't have a license.
I didn't know that.
Yes, well, I guess you don't know everything. Don't you have your own children?
No.
I've got a husband. So, which is he? A husband or a son?
And that's Judy Davis and Essie Davis in a scene there from Nitram. And Ruth, just sticking with you on that, that relationship between the two of them, it's a brief enough scene. It does give you an extraordinary sense of how much of an outsider the Helen character is as well.
Yes, she is. I mean, she evidently lives, she's very rich. And this is the kind of extraordinary twist to the story, because he moves, and they both live then in this very, they're both very isolated then. But what I find interesting too is it's not that she's totally taken in by him, because you see her just looking at him from time to time. This slightly anxious look comes across her, and you think, well, she kind of knows that there's something wrong about what she's just done. And she may even have a sense that she's going to make things worse by giving him this stuff and indulging him and so on. So it's, and then another moment he bounces into her bedroom and jumps into her bed and hugs her, as if he's her child. And so, again, it's just that real strangeness that comes about. And everything's made strange to us.
And to refer to this as entertainment, I think, is probably not quite right. But essentially, Paul, it is a film that we are being given, albeit investigating and looking at the psychological state of this young character. But it's designed to get us to get bums on seats. Is there a question around that? I mean, it's always there when you deal with these real-life events.
Yes.
Is it answered?
Well, I think the question is there because some of the relatives of the victims were very unhappy about this film that focused on him, though some were happy that it stopped short of portraying what happened. But I think it asks a lot of very interesting questions, and I think it does answer them, and I think it justifies its own existence, because always the question is, why does this happen? And that's less of a burning question in America, where where guns are so available and are so often seen as a solution to all ills. But Australia isn't quite like that. And there was a reaction to this, a legal reaction to this straight away. But I think it works as a drama because it draws you in and you are fascinated by the parents' plight, by his total isolation and his complete misunderstanding of the world around him, to the extent that, without giving anything away, there's a video camera. The film ends as the horror is to begin. But the thing that most horrified me was not the guns, it was the video camera. It was the idea that this was a kind of event, you know.
But yet there is a scene in a gun shop where he goes in and he's looking for the semi-automatic rifle, and you just think, how is this man even been given these? And he has no gun license, doesn't need to register. Now that has changed legally in Australia since that, Ruth. But you can't help think of recent events in America.
You can't help. I mean, the recent events in America evidently came out after this film was completed. Yeah. But you can't help think about it. And I mean, probably the actual sole clear-cut villain in this film is the man who sells him the guns, because he knows that he shouldn't be doing it and it's illegal. I mean, he's not a villain, but he doesn't have a gun license, so he shouldn't be. And he decides to overlook it because Nitram is putting wads of cash down on the table. So he's the clear villain in a film that otherwise really doesn't want to make us distance ourselves from somebody because they're a villain, because if they're a villain, then that's easy. But because they're sort of in some way empathetic to us, you know, we can't make those clear-cut judgments.
Stars, and star scenes again seems a little bit crass. But what are you saying here, Ruth?
Well, I'd give it 4 out of 5. I thought it was absorbing and it's a really cerebral and intelligent film.
All right. And what are you saying, Paul?
Well, I would go further and give it 5. I think it's the best thing that he's done. And obviously with you know, caveats for people who intend to go and see it, because it's not Minions.
No, but it certainly isn't.
It's an extraordinary piece of cinema, I think. And I think it's worth watching to try and understand how something like this can happen.
All right. Let's move on then to the Irish documentary made by Ollie Aslin and Gary Lennon, Zones, in on the fascinating story of five Cuban spies located in Miami to gather intelligence on Americans, but also, and perhaps mainly, to monitor anti-Castro sentiment among Cuban exiles in Florida. Castro's Spies is an Irish production made by Gambit Pictures. Let's start with the opening of the film, in fact, is the clip that I want to play. The spies here, who we'll get to know as the film progresses, they're speaking about why they answered the call, and this is interspersed with footage in Spanish from the Cuban TV drama about the story. The first thing that you're going to hear then is an interrogation scene with a Cuban security, with the Spanish guy asking, "Are you a Cuban security agent?" That's the question being asked.
¿Es usted agente de la seguridad cubana?
No.
You have to lie in order to do that job. And you have to be somebody you are not.
¿Es usted comunista?
No. I believe that for every Cuban that is present with such a mission, it would be an honor to accomplish.
To do whatever is necessary for the revolution, that was my answer, not my response.
I knew for sure any action that they asked me to do, I would do it.
You have to use fake identities to war inside the United States.
Well, that's part of the training. In order to be successful, it has to be done quietly and in silence. It's not an easy task, I can say.
Case to know that we and our institutions are being spied upon, are being reported upon, and the information being transmitted back to the Director of Intelligence over in Cuba. And we're not going to stand for it.
So an official of the American government there, the last voice that you heard. But before that, the five spies that make up the Cuban Five, Ruth, in terms of this, because that's what they're referred to along the way.
It's not James Bond,
no,
is it?
No, it certainly isn't. But I suppose give us the context for why these spies were sent into America.
Well, they were sent to Miami to spy. Now, this is actually quite a well-known story. And you know, if it sounds familiar, it's because it was the subject of a film by Olivier Assayas called The Wasp Network, which you can catch on Netflix. And that was a big, you know, all-star film with Penelope Cruz in it. Now, in Assayas' film, they make it really clear that the directive was to spy on the Cubans in exile who were plotting to overthrow Castro. In this film, they're a little bit less clear-cut, because, you know, were they sent to spy on the Cubans in exile or were they sent to spy on the Americans? And I became quite absorbed by that gap, because it seemed to me, well, actually, why would any spy actually tell you what they were doing? So I've decided that the film isn't actually giving us the truth, because I think there was probably more to the spies than they're telling us that they
were doing. Yeah, well, I mean, I just give you their first names as René, Gerardo, Fernando, Roman and Antonio. And I thought, well, these are five Irish fellas called Padraig, Sean, Mick and Peter. You know, like
they are the most ordinary people.
They sound like the most generic names and they look like the most generic guys that you could find, Paul. But they were reacting, or at least the story we're being told here is that they were reacting most of all to the shooting down of a Cuban aircraft.
Yeah, they were. And I don't think this is going to get a wide distribution in America, to be honest, because this is the alternate point of view to the American point of view on Cuba. And I think it's largely accurate, actually.
So you believe the five spies, the stories they're telling here?
Well, more or less I do, because they do mention they were spying on US air bases. They were counting planes, basically, because there would always be increases if there was going to be an incursion and Cuba might be next, because it was always very tense. I think they were doing that, but I do believe their primary goal was to get at these militias, which the CIA and the FBI were allowing to openly operate in the Miami region, and which were carrying out all sorts of indiscriminate terror attacks in Cuba in the late 1960s and 70s, and getting away with it and being hailed as heroes or pretending to be. So that was who they were after. They weren't out to assassinate them, in fairness. They wanted to infiltrate them and thwart them and find out what they were doing and thwart. So I do believe that was their primary aim.
And I said shooting down.
Yet they ended up in all sorts of trouble.
It was an explosion midair on the Cuban passenger aircraft rather than the shooting down. Just one thing on it, Ruth, before we get your stars. I suppose it's about the family stories as much as anything
that's
else.
That's what the real heart of the film is.
Because the guys end up in prison and separated from their wives and families.
Yeah, and they have to they have to pretend they're defecting to the United States in order to spy, because they can't say, I'm going to the United States to spy. And they, you know, their wives and their kids believe that they have betrayed their country. And I mean, what's really heartwarming too is their own sense of patriotism and their real deep loyalty to Cuba and to Castro. And so to betray that in the eyes of the family is just massive. And that's what they had to do.
All right. Stars from you on this one, Ruth?
I'd give it 3.5. I thought it was decent enough. Yeah.
And Paul?
Yeah, I'd give it 4. I think that it avoided the dread, historical recreation. And it used those clips from that Cuban TV drama, stopped it from being too dry. But I thought it was pretty rigorous in terms of the people it talked to. It could have maybe cast its net a bit wider, but I thought it was a very strong documentary.
All right. That's Paul Whittington and Ruth Barton there talking to us about this evening about Castro Spies, that Irish-made documentary. And before that, Nitram and Minions, The Rise of Gru. My Life as a Rolling Stone is the title of a new four-part BBC series celebrating the 60th anniversary of rock and roll's original bad boys, the Rolling Stones, featuring new and lengthy intervals with the three surviving members of the band and contributions from the likes of Tina Turner, Rod Stewart and Bon Jovi. The series comes as the band are on the road yet again, churning out the hits that established them as a huge presence in 20th century popular culture. The makers of the series promised to lift the lid on Rolling Stones' inspirations, the creative sparks that made them unique, their personal demons and their journey from rock and roll rebels to mainstream stadium and cultural icons. But after 60 years, countless biographies and books, libraries worth of interviews and newspaper headlines, TV and radio interviews, what more is there to learn about the band? Pat Carty has watched the series and is with me now. And in fact, there are 4 episodes here, Pat, each of them about a different member of the band, starting with Mick Jagger. And it starts with Jagger sitting down about to start the interview and says, oh, let's not do cliches here. Let's promise not to do that. We're going to lift the lid on everything.
Mm.
Are they really going to lift the lid on everything?
Well, what he says, I mean, I think the interviewer says to him, listen, let's do a cliche. And he goes, now, in the Mick voice. But what he says is that a lot of these documentaries take the mythology and just repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. And then it becomes fact and then you play along with it. And he says, let's try not and do that. And he does to a certain extent. But the thing with Mick Jagger is, you know, obviously he's been doing this for 60 years. He has never given away much in interviews. He was paid an awful lot of money one time to write his biography and returned it, claiming he couldn't remember it. But I think basically he just wants to keep his cards close to his chest.
So what they're doing, the way they're doing this is that their way through it is that each of the 4 episodes has a focus on the different band members. Mick Jagger is first. And what way did they go through the other three?
Mick, Keith, and then Charlie Watts, and then Ronnie. Ronnie Wood, the new boy.
So let's stick with the Mick Jagger side of things here. You know, he's sitting there and he seems affable enough, but as you see, you just wonder, is he going to give anything away? But how quickly do we establish this idea that he kind of, even though Brian Jones had founded the band, that Jagger takes over and Jagger is the front man and that's it. How quickly do we get that?
Well, there's a funny bit in it where he's talking about Brian Jones and Brian, you know, he's talking about Brian going around saying, it's my band. And himself and Keith were saying to each other, really? We think of it as our band. And then there's a clip, which I hadn't seen before, where they're on a bandstand and they're being interviewed and the interviewer goes to Brian Jones and he says, oh, you're one of the main songwriters, aren't you, Brian? And he says, well, no, I'm not actually, I'm not. Because Brian Jones famously never wrote any of the music. Mm. And it's actually Mick and Keith. And you see the interviewer kind of step around Brian Jones, who has a bit of a puss on him.
I thought he had a very annoyed look on his face.
As he would do, perhaps, and go straight to Mick and Keith, knowing that they are the centre of this and the centre of the story. And even then, despite what Brian Jones, and maybe, you know, it's not really covered, his death is obviously mentioned, but it's not really covered that the many causes or possible causes. who knows? Maybe that had something to do with it. You know, he was fired from his own band, pretty much, I suppose, or asked to leave anyway, from what he thought was his own band. And Mick and Keith had stepped past him and become the legendary figures they are.
And you can hardly hear a bad word said by Mick or Keith about each other. Let's listen
that's the strange thing. Yeah.
Let's listen to Keith Richards' description of Mick Jagger as a frontman. This is from that first episode about Mick Jagger.
Mick Jagger's Mick Jagger. He's the best frontman in the business. I mean, he get up there and do his stuff and lay it on you, and he means it. What you see is what you get. You know, I mean, there's loads of facets and variations on him, but he's really a very honourable man, you know. I mean, under all that crap.
One of my big jobs is to be a big show-off, really. I mean, that's really what it is. I suppose that's my job, for 2 hours to make people feel good, to bring people a joyous experience that they have a great evening. And that's what I think my role is.
So there, Mick Jagger at the end. And Keith Richards at the top talking about Mick Jagger as an honourable man. I mean, the story wouldn't go that Keith and Mick were great pals, really. What was the nature of the tension between the two of them?
Well, you know, and this is not discussed in this
at
series.
At all?
No, that episode is. But I mean, just what I'm about to say is not all discussed. Right. I mean, if you want to see where tension starts off, you could go back to where... Mick was filming Performance, the movie he made with James Fox at the end of the 60s, and Keith's girlfriend Anita Pallenberg was in it. And apparently there was a lot of, method acting in the relationship scenes between Mick and Anita, and this caused problems and that caused problems. All this stuff, that is kind of papered over. None of that is mentioned, really.
And so do we get to any sense?
Oh, no, we get a sense that when they had massive falling out in the 80s, and in the Ronnie Wood episode in particular, Ronnie is credited as the kind of, I suppose you could use the Spinal Tap cliche, as the lukewarm water of the band. He's the one in the middle who keeps them together when they really were not talking to each other.
I mean, what was that row about?
Well, it had been building up. Keith was under the... Jagger took over the business side and everything when Keith was a heroin addict. And when Keith came out of that at the end of the 70s and said, you know, let me take some of the responsibility back, maybe he was told, no, you're all right. And they did an album called Dirty Work in the middle of the 80s. And at the last minute, Jagger says, I don't want to tour this. I'm making my own record. And apparently Keith was furious about this. And so they very closely split at that stage. I think they'd even announced at one stage that it was finished at that stage. But it was Ronnie who kept it together and brought them back together. And they came back then for a record for Steel Wheels. And then ever since then, it's been just tour and tour and tour and bigger tour. But if you remember Keith's book, which is rated highly, it wouldn't be rated that highly by me, but he really insults Jagger in it. I mean, he makes claims about the size of his manhood in it, which is very ungentlemanly behaviour. And Jagger apparently was obviously furious, as you would be.
Yeah, but then you get this, you know, he's an absolute gentleman, but then there's a big laugh afterwards. So does this four-part documentary, does it get into the nuts and bolts of the difficulties between the band members, or does it kind of just touch on them?
It's half and half, because it does, you know, Mick does talk about, like he says, oh, people say to me, it's like being in a family and my relationship with Keith is like having a brother. But he says, I have a brother. It's not like that. Mm. I work with him. And then he also comes out, because Jagger does, I mean, reveal some stuff.
Let me play that clip, actually, where he says that. Because, you know, what he said, he says something, but he doesn't say very much. This is Mick Jagger on his relationship with Keith Richards.
It's a collection of individuals, a band, and they say, you're just like brothers, just like a family. It's not like a family at all. I actually have a brother. And I know what it's like to have a brother. It's not like being with Keith at all. It's friendship, and it's friendship and working together, as in friendships or love affairs. People have roles to play, but those roles change. And so it's in a state of flux, so it's never the same. So if you're talking about a band like the Rolling Stones, who've been around such a long time, then all of these things apply.
Jagger and Richards depend on each other more than they'll ever know. Oh, you know, they've had an argument. Oh my God, you know, I mean, and it's all, you know, talk about storms in teacups, you know, I mean, it's like, and so before I know it, you know, Mick and I are actually sort of making up fights just to keep everybody happy, you know. And so it gets ridiculous. No, we're tight.
So there we go. Keith Richards saying they're tight. Yeah. Brian Johnson, the lead singer with AC/DC, in the middle of that clip, and Mick Jagger beforehand. But if you listen to that, Pat Kelly, you know, they're really not saying anything. Oh, you know, it's like a family. He's not my brother. Mm. It's not been like that. It's not like that being with Keith. But he doesn't tell us what it is like being with Keith.
You know, first of all, there's one thing Keith says there, you know, that could be true. Maybe some of these fights have been exaggerated for the effect of the press, you know. It never did the Gallaghers any harm to be fighting all the time, kept them in the papers. The other side is that these are recent interviews, very recent, and they were done after Charlie Watts had passed away.
Right.
So maybe that changed the dynamic. There was footage, they played in Hyde Park last Saturday, and there was footage of them being very affectionate with each other and hugging and things like that. So maybe at this stage of their lives, you know, they've come to terms with each other and one of their, you know, the fellow who was there behind them for 60 years is gone. Maybe that's changed the relationship again.
Yeah, yeah. What about the music itself? Mm. Do we get much analysis and detail into the writing of various songs along the way? I saw the first episode. They did touch on Satisfaction and what they were trying to do there in terms of songs for the ordinary guy, because they'd done a lot of cover versions really up until
Yeah, they were. And they talk about when their manager, Andrew Lou Goldham, told them they had to write songs, and that was it. And that was, and they had written songs before that. But with Satisfaction, they really hit on something. I think it was Brian Johnson again who in the show, he was talking about how the working man's life hadn't changed at all. And, you know, you were going to work and you were doing this and you're doing that. And then you heard this song ring out on the radio and it changed everything. And what Jagger says is it became a signature. And it really is what made them huge, first of all, you know, all over the world.
A little bit of Satisfaction there from the Rolling Stones. Pat Carthy is with me this evening talking about the new four-part BBC series, My Life as a Rolling Stone. That first episode deals with Mick Jagger. The second episode deals with Keith Richards. But I think the one that really works for you, in fact, ironically, even though he's not present in terms of a of the moment interview, is the third one, the Charlie Watts one, Pat.
Yeah, it's charming, really, in for want of a better word, and it's sad as well. And obviously, everybody talks about how great he was, but there's great scenes in it. Charlie was never much of a man for being interviewed anyway. But the small few snippets they have of him, there's one very funny scene where someone's talking to him and he's kind of looking bored, and it says, "Yeah, in 25 years of working with the Stones, Charlie, you must have done an awful lot of hanging around." He says, "Yeah, 5 years working, 20 years hanging around." And but they go into his life, you know, that he had a little drum museum set up that I'd never seen before, where he has all these drums from people like Elvin Jones and Max Roach that he'd bought. They showed the tea set in a flight case that he used to bring on tour. They go to his tailor in Savile Row. Obviously, he was well known for his suits. And the tailor brings out the pattern that he has for various customers. And you see David Bowie's one there, and it's one sheet, you know. And then he brings out Charlie Watts, and it's a huge big book, because Charlie was never out of the place. Mm. And they always called him Mr. Watts. And it goes to his house in Devon, where he has, I think they had 15 dogs at one stage and all these horses, and his collection of cars that he could never drive, but he bought all these vintage cars, and he used to put on a suit to match the colour of the car to go and sit in the car.
Just to sit in the car.
And also, I mean, they talk about his drumming. Sorry, I should say as well. They talk about his drumming and how great he was. And he was fantastic. And they even, when they're trying to discover some new beats, they put on Dr. Dre's The Chronic album in the studio, and Charlie's able to play along faultlessly to it. He was that good.
All right. Just give me something on some of the talking heads that are here, because there are some big names actually talking about the Rolling Stones.
There are, yeah. There are people like Jon Bon Jovi and Slash and people like that, and Brian Johnson that we mentioned. And a lot of them are just kind of, Mick is the great greatest frontman ever.
That's what we're going to ask you. Did they tell us Keith anything new?
I mean, the ones I thought were good were Tina Turner revealed that, you know, when she used to tour with the Stones, with Ike and Tina, and she talks about Mick standing backstage and watching her every move because he would copy it. And then after that, Jagger comes on, and that is a revealing thing where he says, look, I knew television was important. So I used to go to Ready, Steady, Go and things like that, even when we weren't on, and watch where the cameras were and then go home and practice my moves. So I'd stand out more than everyone else. And the other one I thought was good, Chrissy Hynde is very funny on it, I thought, because she does say a thing about Keith Richards. She says, look, every man I've ever met wants to be Keith Richards. And I know that that's a true fact because it happened to me. So, you know, I think they're funny, but I think a lot of them are a bit...
Is there enough in it to sit down and watch all four episodes?
For me, I would have seen all this before, but then I'm obsessive. I'm nerd when it comes to this stuff. But I think in general, yes, there is, because the interviews are good, and especially the Charlie one is excellent.
Episode 3. That's Pat Carthy taking a look at the new four-part documentary, My Life is a Rolling Stone. First episode, concentrating, as we said, on Mick Jagger, will be aired on BBC Two television tomorrow evening. We spoke to writer Luke Cassidy last August about his novel Iron Annie, a tale of crime and ill-fated romance set in his native Dundalk. Follows the narrator Aoife and her partner, beautiful, mysterious Annie, as they take off on a road trip to the UK, having stolen 10 kilos of cocaine from a local rival. Since August, Iron Annie itself has gone on the road as a cabaret-style stage show and comes to Dublin and Belfast in July. The book has received 2 award nominations. It is one of 3 books up for the Desmond Elliott Prize for First Novel. The winner is due to be announced in London tomorrow. It's also been long listed for the Festival de Premier Roman de Chambéry in France. Another first novel involved there. Luke Cassidy joins me this evening. Just to bring us back, if you would, Luke, to the borderlands world of the novel and remind us of Aoife and Annie and who they are.
Hi there, Sean. Thanks for having me again. It's lovely to be on. And I should start, Sean, by pointing out that you mentioned Belfast and Dublin, and of course we're also bringing the show back to Dundalk, which is of course where it all started.
Most important in
the Spirit Store, you know. So for anyone listening out there, that's also a place that kind of quite inspired me. Some of the action in the book is set there. And I think that your question is a very good one, because the characters, a lot of the characters, not Annie, obviously, but a lot of the other characters are, you know, they're very rooted in that place, in this sort of like specific border atmosphere, you know, which is something that we have around there, this kind of sense of, well, you know, DIY, as you mentioned, you know, there is this criminal element to it, but I always explain the sort of the wheeler dealer character that Aoife is, of course, which is sort of, she'd as soon sell, you know, counterfeit fags as she would a ton of spuds. So this is really kind of her perspective on things. And there's a lot of comedy as well in that, which I think is a very specific imprint, let's say, that is a legacy of the border, as I've come to understand it, as a sort of a survival mechanism, you know.
And Iron Annie then, which is this cabaret show, or the novel rather, is teeming with life, larger than life characters. So I know when we spoke, you already had the idea of this stage show, but how do you transfer something that it's so novelistic? How do you transfer that onto the stage, or how did you?
Well, what I did was to focus in, really, because I didn't want to sort of truncate the story of everything that goes on, everything that you've mentioned, which is very, as you say, novelistic. But I wanted to focus in on that relationship between Aoife and Annie, and sort of tell this kind of a very tender human story of somebody falling for somebody that they know they shouldn't, you know, quite aside from the bits of action that are thrown in that kind of hint at the drugs and the different things that are going on. But it's this sort of very, I think, very relatable for anyone's story of, you know, you're falling for somebody you really shouldn't be. And despite all of the warning signs, you know, there's great charisma there. And this in the story really comes down to this sort of special moment. I don't want to give too much away, but it does involve music. And therefore, for me, quite naturally, also because Dundalk, it should be said, has a great music scene. Yeah. And that's been a great inspiration to me for a long time. So this was sort of bringing that back in. I just kind of got in contact with people who I've known for a long time, and sort of proposed to them to compose music, basically not in the sense of it being a musical as such, but to take the emotional content of the book and of the play as well, and to sort of create these sort of emotional counterpoints through the very divergent forms of punk rock and folk ballads. So this has been a tremendously beautiful experience, actually, to see that, people
essentially
take
what
your
we get,
work. And,
yeah, we get George Acuna is the actor in this particular set mm-hmm. of performances. We get her doing, I suppose, like monologue sections from the novel itself. And it's not that the music then is part of the action. It just it's a comment in some ways in the action. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. How I imagine it is, it's a kind of an illustration, if you like. It's a sort of bringing her emotional state to life. And because of the type of a story that it is, you know, it's quite back and forth between these moments of kind of anxiety and also very warm, tender feelings towards this other person.
Yeah, well, let's have a listen to Georgia. We have a short clip from the production here. Georgia Cooney is Aoife, and she's recalling the moment, a moment of seeing Annie sing and just how important that was to her. A little bit of language in the midst of this clip, you should be warned.
Upstairs, I see Annie on stage, singing. The fuck, like? And she's a beautiful singer, but I never heard her sing before, never. I didn't know she was really into music. I feel kind of scared because it's like I don't know her, but I'm also just totally stilled by the beauty of it. I think I knew then that I loved her. I mean, I admitted it. And I didn't even care that there was loads of things I didn't know about her.
And that's Georgia Cooney there as Aoife in a clip from the upcoming Iron Annie, the cabaret version of the novel written by Luke Cassidy. And Luke is with me on the programme this evening. It's not just that Georgia plays the character of Aoife doing those narrations. She has quite a task then throughout. Does she play a bundle of the other characters, or is she just telling us about the other characters, Luke?
If you like, the script is in such a way that she will relate parts of their sort of what would be in the novel as dialogue. She would sort of reduce that to a snippet, let's say. And so it's like somebody doing somebody, like your man says to me, and then you put on a version of that person. But, you know, talking about her, you know, the other characters in the story, whether that be Annie or whoever. I think I should mention as well, I think it's relevant to mention, Georgia is a Dundalk woman herself, and this is her first gig out of college. So it was a really big delight for myself and Rhiann Jeffrey, who's Belfast director, who is joining me on the project, and basically to have kind of met Georgia kind of very serendipitously and to be able to bring her on board.
Yeah, and of course for her to be bringing it back to Dundalk, I'm sure is a pretty important move for her as well. Just on the novel itself, as I said, you're in London tomorrow for the Desmond Elliot Awards ceremony. Have you high hopes, or how do you feel about those type of awards and being on a shortlist?
Yeah, I mean, any kind of recognition is great, isn't it? It's a shortlist of three books, so I mean, I like those odds, but at the same time, they're two, you know, tremendous novels, two tremendous novelists that I'm on the list with. So I don't take anything for granted. I'm glad to be there and to sort of have the chance to actually, because the novel as well was published under the circumstances of COVID, so there was very little. You were quite constrained. You might remember. So it's
a chance to get it back out there again. Yeah. Well, listen, congratulations 100%. On the nomination. Best of luck tomorrow night, Luke, and hope it all goes well. And as you said, no matter what, the nomination is already a win in many ways, isn't it? That's Luke Cassidy there.
Indeed.
Iron Annie, the cabaret show, or the stage version of the novel, runs at Smock Alley Theatre in Dublin from the 21st through until the 23rd of July. An Accidental Theatre in Belfast then on the 29th and 30th of July. And as Luke mentioned to us, there are also performances in Dublin Dundalk. You'll get further details on smockalley.com and accidentaltheatre.co.uk. But that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Paula Shields researched. Amandine Passel Devine was the broadcast coordinator. Harry Bookus was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. I will talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.